I had a fun day yesterday. I can actually tell you that my two older sons and I were on national television yesterday. So I don't know if you are all aware, if you're familiar with it, but there's an auto auction show that's on TV that's televised nationally called the Mecum Auto Auctions, and that was down in Dallas. But we had a fun time, and we were actually in the background on a couple of shots. So you can't really see us. If you didn't know, you'd have to know it was us. So, but still, it was kind of fun to see ourselves a little bit on national TV. So I've been telling my son Joshua, he doesn't believe me, but I keep telling him that we're now famous. So he doesn't believe me, though. He won't accept it. But anyway, the story that we've actually come to today actually is on the heels of somebody, David, who has actually truly become famous in the land. He has, there in Israel, suddenly come onto the scene, and as we'll see as we get into it, he is the topic of conversation. He is the one that everybody's excited about, and we'll see as the Lord is blessing him and his life, and he is rising up through the ranks and so on, that he is becoming famous, as it were. And so we're going to see in these situations how a couple of specific men, namely Jonathan and Saul, are going to respond to David as David is rising into prominence. And that's really the topic and the focus of 1 Samuel 18 that we're going to get into today. Now, we mentioned last week in chapter 17 that the focus on 1 Samuel shifts towards David. However, really the chapter that we are in today, the focus, as you'll see throughout most of the chapter, is on Saul. Jonathan in the beginning and then shifting towards Saul. Obviously, David is involved, but what we see here in Saul is a degenerating view of David such that he ends up seeking to end David's life. So this passage is integral to the overall story because it serves as the link between the events of David killing Goliath and chapter 19 and following. The very first part of chapter 19, Saul is publicly and openly trying to kill David, trying to get somebody to go kill him. And so what happened? Here, an amazing victory, actually making Saul look really good, and then Saul's trying to kill him. Without understanding why or what happened, we might surmise that there was a legitimate reason that Saul had to go after David. We might surmise that David had committed some form of treason against Saul or had done something else that rightfully deserved the king's condemnation. And under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, the writer here provides a glimpse into the inner workings and motivations of Saul's heart. And what we'll see is that there is a deep-seated evil in his heart that is opened and laid bare by the Holy Spirit to us. And so this chapter makes it very clear that the reason that Saul sought to end David's life was that he came to understand that David was the man whom God had chosen in the place of Saul, and then we'll see Saul continuing in his rebellion towards the Lord. So the reason that Saul was after David in the coming chapter, well, in this chapter and the coming chapters, is not because of something David did, because it was because of Saul's evil and rebellious heart. So it's an important connection, like I said, between David and his victory over Goliath and the ensuing victory over the Philistines, as well as Saul's response. Now, in this story, there's a couple of notable contrasts that we're going to see. First off, there's a contrast between Saul's response to David and Jonathan's response to David. Secondly, there's a contrast that we see as well, and it's that contrast of David versus Saul. David, as we've already seen, was a young man of strong, biblically guided confidence in the Lord. At the same time, we will see the sorry depths of the depravity of Saul's heart with his corrupt motivations and thinking. Saul is not a man whose confidence was in God. Instead, we find him as a man who was, as it were, running from God. We don't see repentance. We don't see humility. Instead, we see a string of self-focused, self-exalting efforts to thwart what he knows to be God's sovereign plans for David and for the kingdom. And so we will see Saul sinking deeper and deeper into things like depression, paranoia, anger, pride, anxiety, suspicion, lies, scheming, contempt, and even murder. It's a sad testimony. And of course, the remarkable contrast is that of David, when we see David responding the way that he does. So in this chapter, I've identified six different episodes, and we'll walk through those different episodes that help to unveil the story. So if you'll start with me, we're going to look at that first episode, and I've entitled that episode one, An Unlikely Friend, and this is in verses 1-5. So 1 Samuel chapter 18, if you haven't already turned there, please do so, but I will begin there in verse 1. It says, "Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul," and by the way, he is meaning David from the previous chapter, "but it came about as he," David, "had finished speaking with Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered. And Saul set him over the men of war, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants." Now let me set the stage here for you just a bit. Jonathan was really the prince of Israel, likely the second in command here and the heir apparent to the throne. And so, and along comes this young upstart that demonstrated a remarkable faith and confidence in the Lord and dispatched the Philistine champion who no one else even dared to face. David, in effect, showed everyone else up. So, with that in mind, how might Jonathan have been tempted to wrongly respond to David? Class participation time. Jealousy? Sure. Suspicion? Absolutely. What else?
Envy.
Yeah, you bet. Here David has accomplished this great feat, and now Jonathan was no slouch either when it came to prowess in battle. We'll talk about that in a minute. But what else?
Might have feared him.
Yeah, might have been scared of him. I don't know if you've been in situations like that when maybe you've been working and working a long time and then somebody comes up that's actually outshining you. Can be a difficult thing to get past. But that's what we essentially have here. Here is Jonathan who didn't go out to fight Goliath and who nevertheless is a believer and the Lord has blessed him. And so absolutely, his response could be any number of wrong things. We'll see the wrong responses reflected in the life of Saul, but here for Jonathan, we don't see that. Now, a little bit about Jonathan. By the way, Jonathan's response is a wonderful lesson to us as believers as how we should be responding to those whom God has extraordinarily blessed. Jonathan, as we said, he could have been envious or he could have attempted to offset David's successes by touting his own. Or he could have grown despondent and just decided to quit. In a few months, we'll get to the story of Absalom and how he attempted to overthrow David. But Absalom had a very smart counselor named Ahithophel. And After David hightailed it out of Jerusalem when Absalom was coming down to overthrow him, and by the way, that was a genius move on David's part. We'll get to that later on. But Ahithophel advised Absalom to immediately dispatch soldiers to hunt David down. But David had secretly left his own buddy Hushai to spy on Absalom and to try to thwart the counsel of Ahithophel. And so in this scenario that we find there, Hushai's counsel was accepted over Ahithophel's counsel, and Ahithophel's response was to go kill himself. If Absalom isn't going to listen to me, then I guess I'm no good anymore. Kind of developed an Eeyore complex, as it were. But Jonathan could have responded to David's successes in the same way or a similar way, or in another wrong way, but that's not what we see. Now, it might be actually helpful to understand a little bit about Jonathan. Here we're picking up in the story of the life of David, and so we haven't actually studied and gone through what came previously, but Jonathan was actually similar in several ways to David. So he was a warrior, he was a man of faith, a man of courageous faith even, and in 1 Samuel 14, we see the story where Jonathan and his armor bearer secretly left the camp of Israel during a battle and went to check out the Philistine garrison. And Jonathan said in 1 Samuel 14, verse 6, we read, says, "Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, 'Come, let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few.'" So Jonathan, it was just him and his armor bearer, they decide to go over, check out the Philistine garrison, and then they end up attacking the Philistine garrison. And as they attacked, he and his armor bearer killed 20 guys, and then God helped them out with an earthquake, and that was created some confusion in the camp where the Philistines started to fight each other, and then Israelites sort of started to appear out of the woodwork, so to speak, because they were hiding in caves and bushes and cisterns, and suddenly there's this big group of Israelites, and they begin to pursue the Philistines, and then Saul joins in the battle, and so on, and it ends up being a tremendous victory. So, but it started kind of in a lot of ways similar to how David started with Goliath. This young man, this man Jonathan had gone up and said, "You know what? I am confident that the Lord is the one who decides the battles." Similar things to what David was saying. He also called the Philistines the uncircumcised, exactly the same word that David used to describe Goliath. So Jonathan was in many ways very similar to David. By the way, during that same episode, Jonathan had unwittingly eaten honey after Saul had issued a decree, unbeknownst to Jonathan, that no one could eat until evening. And so Saul was determined to put Jonathan to death, but the other soldiers stepped in to say, "No way." And it reveals really how highly regarded Jonathan was by the other soldiers, such that they were willing to stand up against King Saul and rescue Jonathan. So he was highly, highly regarded by the other soldiers. And in today's passage, we'll see that Jonathan makes a covenant with David. And what Daryl will be covering next week, Lord willing, is that Jonathan's enduring faithfulness to David, even when he understood, when he came to understand that David would be the one who would ascend to the throne instead of him. Jonathan remains true to his word and true to his covenant. So he was an admirable man of true faith in the Lord, who displayed an appropriately biblical perspective and understanding, and who was really a compelling portrait to us of a godly and committed friend. So let's see how that plays out. Jumping back into verse 1 here, says, "Now it came about when David had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and David loved him as himself. Now, this verse shows us Jonathan's initial response to David. And it tells us two things in that initial response. First off, that their souls were knit together. The idea here is that Jonathan's heart shared a strong connection with David that was really based on something outside of them. There was something, some force that was actually bringing them together in a unique way. And I think we have to conclude that the connection here was not just based on externals. It wasn't because David was a good-looking guy because he had prowess in battle. It wasn't because he necessarily defeated the Philistine champion. I think Jonathan is seeing much more than that in David, and I think we should understand that there was more going on. And so I believe that what Jonathan saw in David was something that was near and dear to his own heart. I believe that what we're seeing here is the unifying connection that God's true believers automatically have. I know that in my own life, when I have met people that I come to understand that they are in Christ, there's an immediate sense that, hey, we're in this thing together. And that's what we see going on in Jonathan, or with Jonathan and David. This is ultimately a unity that is based upon their common faith in the living God. It's a recognition that the two of them are, in a sense, on the same side and working towards the same end, which was to see the Lord glorified in and through his people. That was Jonathan's desire. We know it was also David's desire. And so that collective desire that the both of them had brought them together in a special and unique way. So that's the first thing, is that there was this unity that existed based on their love and care for the living God. The second thing that we're told here is that Jonathan loved David as himself. So when you hear that phrase, love as himself, does that remind you of anything? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The second greatest commandment. There's a few places that's mentioned, but one is in Mark chapter 12, and you, I think, are probably familiar with the story where the Sadducee, or the Pharisee, comes up to Jesus and asks him, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus' response is, out of Deuteronomy chapter 6, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. And then he says, the second like it is to love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus there is quoting from Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, which says, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh. That was an emphatic command that God had given his people, that they were to love each other in the same way and in the same measure that they love themselves. It's a high standard. Often we're very good at loving ourselves. We do that well. We're not very good often about loving another. So what we see here is really a remarkable thing. And I think the point that the writer is making is that this is the kind of love for another that God commanded through this Old Testament law, but it implies a self-sacrificing care and concern for others and a dedication to do what is right and best for them. And this, by the way, is a love of action and decision. It's not necessarily a love of feeling and emotion, although those can be appropriately involved. This is a love of choice, commitment, not a wavering feeling. And in the following verses, we will see really how Jonathan put feet to his commitment to David. And I think The emphasis here is that Jonathan saw in David a man that was committed to the Lord such that he acted on his convictions, and Jonathan here made the decision that he was going to align himself with David and do whatever he could to encourage David, to care for him, and to support him. I think that's what we see going on. By the way, another note, Jonathan at this point was much older than David. There is some debate among commentators on exactly how old, and I'll be honest, I haven't completely studied through it all myself, so I don't have a firm conviction on it at this point, but Jonathan was possibly in his 40s, and David was likely in his mid-teens. So there was very possibly a 20-plus year difference between these two. So this is not unlike an older man in the church recognizing the potential of a younger man and coming alongside that younger man to befriend, to teach, to encourage, to challenge, to pray for, to find opportunities for, and to support. And I can say that when this happens in the church among God's people, our Lord is honored. And when it happens, it is a source of immeasurable and profound blessing to those young men. Well, moving on in our passage, we come here to verse 2. Verse 2 is kind of oddly interjected in the flow. Starts out talking about David and his love and care and concern for, Jonathan and his love for David. And then we get this inserted, which says, Saul took him, meaning David, that day and did not let him return to his father's house. And this essentially means that Saul decided to conscript David into the king's full-time service. So it's just added in here. It helps us to understand that probably Jonathan knew that, and Jonathan was recognizing that they're going to be together a lot more. And so that may have been part of what helped Jonathan, but we don't know for sure. But the point is that David was not going home anymore. He was going to be working permanently in the king's court. And then we see, moving on in verses 3 and 4, really the lengths that Jonathan went to demonstrate his commitment to David. There we see that it says, Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And then we see Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, gave it to David with his armor, including his sword, his bow, and his belt. So here are two other things that we see as responses to David, actually three others. And the first is that Jonathan made a covenant with David. Now, this is a little bit out of the ordinary, but a covenant is a serious and solemn vow, really in the context of a relationship where Jonathan committed himself to David. This was really Jonathan's way of demonstrating to David that he meant what he said. It wasn't that Jonathan was just wanting to jump on David's bandwagon and ride it as long as it benefited himself, but he wanted David to know and understand that he fully intended to be his committed ally and friend. So he was serious about it, and he wanted David to know it. So he makes this covenant, which is a very, very serious vow between two people. And notice this isn't necessarily a covenant that is a bilateral covenant where David is promising things and Jonathan is promising things. We will see that later on in a future chapter. But at this point, it just seems like Jonathan is making a unilateral covenant with David. It's a very, very serious promise where he's saying, David, essentially, if I don't carry out what I'm telling you I'm going to do, you can come and take my life. It's a serious thing. Secondly, we see that Jonathan gave his robe to David. And this is emblematic, really, of Jonathan's high position, and it was a way of demonstrating that he fully supported David. Now, some commentators actually see this as a formal abdication of the throne. I don't really think that makes sense here. Jonathan will later come to understand that David is God's anointed, and Jonathan is going to embrace that. We'll see that happen. But I don't know that that's known and understood at this point. We'll see Saul beginning to grow in his suspicion of David, but I don't think Jonathan caught on yet that that was what was going on. So David here giving, or Jonathan giving his robe to David is actually more of a public proclamation of Jonathan's trust and support. Now, understand that David was previously a shepherd. Shepherds, even then, were considered to be one of the lowest ranking societal classes. We'll even see David referencing that in upcoming portions of this chapter. And again, think contrast. Saul, representing the people's choice, tall, handsome, seemingly intelligent, it's an obvious choice that the people would have made, versus God's choice, who is a lowly redneck shepherd. So Jonathan's support here illustrated that he was willing to set aside social status and norms and support the young man whom God was clearly blessing, despite the fact that this young man was coming from a background and a family that wasn't similar to Jonathan's. I think it's an important lesson there. Thirdly, we see him bestowing his armor and weapons upon David. If you remember, David tried on Saul's armor, but it just didn't work for him. Probably because Saul was a tall man, we know that, and likely quite a bit taller than David. So when David tried that on, it didn't work. So Jonathan bestowing his weapons and armor was possibly because David needed them. So Jonathan was meeting a need, but likely, and really more importantly, it was again this public illustration of Jonathan's high regard for and support of David. George Patton was one of the most well-known generals in World War II, and he was known to almost always be carrying two revolvers, one on each hip. He had a Colt 45 and a 357 Magnum revolver, and both of those guns, along with most of his other guns, he had outfitted with ivory handles that were engraved with his initials and sometimes his general insignia. But imagine the enormous vote of confidence if George Patton, the great general of World War II, gave his special revolvers to an up-and-coming lieutenant after that lieutenant had achieved some victory. The lieutenant would have, by that one act, immediately and automatically secured the great respect of all the other soldiers and, in fact, the whole country. The news agencies would be writing stories and telling about how Patton had such confidence and was so impressed by this young man that he gave him his cherished revolvers. It's similar. Jonathan is, in a sense, doing the same thing here. There had really been no greater public honor that Patton could bestow on another soldier. It's the same thing with Jonathan. There was really little other that Jonathan could do to honor David than to give him his specially made armor. Likely the nicest armor in all the army. Likely the nicest sword in all the army. And he doesn't stop there. He also gives him his robe. So imagine when David emerged from the tent wearing Jonathan's armor and robe. I doubt that there was anyone else that Jonathan had ever done such a thing for. And then since the soldiers had such high regard for Jonathan, they would have immediately understood the tremendous respect and support that Jonathan had for David, and he and David would have had the other soldiers' immediate respect. So this was a wonderful, wonderful thing that Jonathan did for David. Now, verse 5 here, we could read verse 5 as just some other unconnected details of the story, but I'm not sure. I think it makes sense to understand it in context because it's making a statement. It says here, so David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul set him over the men of war. And note this, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. That last part there, I think that Jonathan's actions for David went a long way in helping to prosper David and helping to secure the respect and support of the army and the servants of Saul. David was elevated to a leadership position in the army. And so I think it's highly probable that the response from the other soldiers and servants was greatly aided by Jonathan's actions and support. So what a great friend. What a tremendous ally that David found in Jonathan. And we'll see in future chapters how that plays out, where Jonathan saves David's life, rescues him from his own father, secretly meets with him, and we'll get a chance to go through that, some of that, in the next week. All right, so that's episode one, an unlikely friend. So we turn now to episode two, which is, and by the way, we're turning now to Saul. We see how Jonathan responded. How is Saul going to respond? So we start with a jealous suspicion in verses 6 through 9. And there we read, "It happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out of the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and musical instruments. And the women sang as they played and said, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s.' Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him, and he said, 'They have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they've only ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?' And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on." So this episode here begins with a victory parade to honor King Saul and his soldiers. This was a common practice and would be similar to a ticker tape parade that we might see today. It was a celebration of the victory, and it, of course, would be accompanied by singing and dancing and music as the king made his way back into the palace. In this celebration, one of the songs made this statement that you see here in the text, that Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Now, this was almost certainly an innocent song where the people were celebrating Saul and Saul's new champion, David. In point of fact, David had killed a sum total of one in this battle. So now they're getting 10,000s from one. Now, we know that that one was an extremely significant victory. But beyond that, it actually served as the catalyst for the Israelites jumping into battle and chasing down and slaughtering the Philistine soldiers. So they are likely attributing the bulk of the victory here to David. The point of the song was not to suggest that David was better than Saul, which is how Saul took it, but that wasn't the point. Instead, it was just simply to celebrate the victory and the significance of David's hand in it. Really, on this day, David was the one who deserved the honor. And a gracious leader would have understood that. And a gracious leader, a good leader, would have been the one celebrating it more than everybody else. That's not what we see here, though. Saul should have been the one telling the stories and slapping David on the back and laughing about David's little slingshot felling the great giant and handing out medals and so on. But instead, Saul takes great offense. Notice the text says that he became very angry. If you look at it, this is just petty-mindedness on the part of Saul. Shows how inward and self-focused Saul was. Note Saul's conclusion on this was, number one, suspicion we see, but Saul actually says, what more can he have but the kingdom? You get a sense of self-pity. Everyone thinks David is better than I am. He might as well just take over the throne. And that thought probably struck a chord in Saul's heart. He had been told that he was rejected from being king and that another would take over the throne. And we see that in 1 Samuel 15, verse 28, where it says, so Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. So likely those words were echoing in Saul's mind as he hears this song and he puts two and two together. And in this scenario, David is unintentionally elevated so that at least Saul takes it as though they are saying that David is better than Saul. And so we get verse 9 that says that Saul from that day on began to look at David with suspicion. Saul is suspicious that David is the one whom God has selected to take the throne. Now, he's suspicious of it. I don't think by this point he's completely figured it out. I don't think he's 100% sure yet, but he's suspicious. And that brings us to the next episode, which is a murderous outburst. And we see that in verse 10 and 11. Says, now it came about on the next day, so the very next day after the victory parade, that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house, while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual. And a spear was in Saul's hand. And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped from his presence twice. Now here we see the statement that Saul raved in his house, and the catalyst of this raving was an evil spirit from God. We saw this and talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Terry explained this, but some people look at this idea that God sent an evil spirit as being something that God cannot and will not do. Well, that's not true. This is not the only story in the Old Testament where God actually sends a demon to bring about his purposes. And this is something that can be hard to understand, but we should remember that God's purposes are always for the good of his people and for his own glory, although he often uses sinful, evil people and beings to bring about those plans. We know from James 1:13 that God is not tempted, nor does he directly tempt anyone to evil. In other words, God is never the cause of anyone's sin. As James goes on to say, we sin when we are carried away with our own lusts, and when those lusts have conceived, it gives birth to sin. So the problem is not what God is doing. The problem is us and our own hearts. We need to understand that. And really, God's purpose in sending this evil spirit to Saul was a consequence of Saul's sin. Part of the consequence when Saul rejected God is that God would not allow Saul to just be at peace. In some ways, we could even see this as something that should have driven Saul back to God. Saul was a mess. He couldn't have been enjoying that, and I don't think we can surmise that he would, or that he did. He had to know that what was necessary to respond to this situation was his own repentance. And yet Saul continued in his own stubborn refusal to submit his will to the obedience of God's law and word. So Saul's problem was not the evil spirit. Saul's problem was his own rebellious heart. There's another instance in Scripture where God uses insanity to teach someone their proper place, and that's the story of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, as you know, goes crazy for 7 years. And then after that 7 year period, Nebuchadnezzar's reason returned to him, it says, but he learned his lesson and responded appropriately in what became a marvelous testimony of the gracious goodness of God to humble those who walk in pride. I think we should see that part of God's intention could have been with this evil spirit to call Saul back into fellowship with the Lord. Of course, Saul rejects that. Now, this word here that he raved is an interesting word. So we're told that Saul raved in the middle of his house. Notice it says, and then David was playing as usual. So this was something that was a common occurrence in this house. But what did this raving look like? The word that's used here is actually the same word that's translated in other places as prophesy or prophesied. So, by extension, we can understand that this involved Saul's speech. So when he's raving, he's running off at the mouth, whatever way that looks. So I imagine it involved a lot of anger and yelling, probably swearing, the kind of talking that comes from people who have deeply troubled minds or various forms of significant mental instability or illness. Some of what he said may have even been unintelligible, but how embarrassing. How un-king-like. And it was likely that everyone would sense that mood coming on and clear the house. It seems like David is there by himself, because if others had been around, Saul might not have attempted to kill David the way he did. But on this occasion, the result is that Saul tried to kill David by throwing his spear at him, and he does it twice. Notice, by the way, this shows a notable humility on the part of David, that he was willing to go back to his older, lower-level job of playing the harp. He's just had a great victory. He's been honored by Jonathan and what Jonathan does, but we don't see David complaining. He goes back to his job of playing the harp, trying to help Saul when Saul is going through this situation. Shows that David wasn't getting caught up in the wild rise to prominence. That brings us to episode 4, which I've entitled A Growing Paranoia. That's in verses 12 through 16. We read there that says, now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as a commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him, but all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. So Saul was afraid of David. And the question is why? And we're told here in the text, it's because Saul understood that the Lord was working in and through David. Saul understood because of his own experience, when God was with Saul, Saul accomplished some pretty extraordinary things. And so he's seeing that in the life of David now, and he knows very well that that same influence, that same direction and prospering that he once experienced is no longer available to him. And so he is afraid of David. So we see suspicion in the beginning, growing to this outburst that we see, growing into fear in this passage. And so Saul's response to this is that he decides to give David a new responsibility that removes him from his presence. So what he's trying to say is, well, he's escaped from me twice, but man, just me being around him, I don't want to be around him anymore. I want him away. And so he promotes him and gives him some other job so that he wouldn't be around. But, of course, God continues to bless David in all his endeavors. And as Saul continues to see the Lord's blessing, his fear just grows into something that appears to be even more debilitating in the life of Saul. Notice it says there at the end that he dreaded David. And the word here that's translated as dread is literally that Saul dreaded David's face. Again, the idea is Saul doesn't even want to see him. He doesn't want to have anything to do with him. He wants him to be far away. And I think his thought is, if he's just far away, maybe the things that God has promised are going to take place won't. So again, we see Saul, in essence, running from what he knows God has ordained. Next, we see episode 5, which is a duplicitous proposal in verses 17 through 19. There we read, "Then Saul said to David, 'Here's my older daughter Merab, and I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles.' For Saul thought, 'My hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him.' But David said to Saul, 'Who am I, and what is my life or my father's family in Israel, that I should be the king's son-in-law?' So it came about at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, for his wife." So here Saul decides to try a different tactic. He decides that it would be a lot better for him if he wasn't the one deliberately going after David. And so his thought is that if he puts him in a more and more dangerous situation, then hopefully one of the Philistines would kill him and then Saul could save face. In other words, he's basically saying, let's let the Philistines do the dirty work. And so the enticement here is really a couple of things. Number one, he's essentially offering David a promotion in the army, and this would have been a promotion that would put David in harm's way in a much more significant way than he was currently. And bonus, it came along with Saul's daughter. And so this was, so Saul was basically using his own daughter for his own secretly devious and self-focused purposes. What a guy. Aren't fathers supposed to protect and take care of their daughters? Again, this just shows us the level to which Saul is descending, such that he would use his own daughter in this way. Depravity in the rebellious heart just sinks lower and lower. And in this case, David turns down the promotion, really citing his lowly social status. He says, "Who am I that I should be the king's son?" and so on. But this points out as well something of David's character. But we see in David that he was not ambitious. He wasn't trying to play the game or climb the corporate ladder. He didn't jump at the opportunity. There was something that held him back. And we aren't completely sure why, but it seems likely that he was concerned about the bride price that he would customarily have had to pay. And that seems to make the most sense, because in the next proposal, Saul offers another way for David to pay the bride price for his next daughter. So, but whatever happened, this refusal of David apparently came on the very day when the marriage was supposed to have taken place. And so David didn't show up at the altar, apparently. And so somebody else stood in his place and Merab was given to another man. However, the day is not yet done. So we come to episode 6, which I've entitled An Intended Snare. We see that beginning in verse 20. There we read, "Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. When they told Saul, the thing was agreeable to him, and Saul thought, 'I will give her to him, that she may become a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him.' Therefore Saul said to David, 'For a second time, you may be my son-in-law today.' Then Saul commands his servants, speak to David secretly, saying, behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. So Saul's servants spoke these words to David. But David said, is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? David here is again referring to that lowly social status and his inability to pay the customary bride price. The servants of Saul reported to him according to these words which David spoke, and then Saul then said, thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. Now Saul plans to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when the servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Before the days had expired, David rose up and he went, he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins and gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave Michal his daughter for a wife. So this is one of those situations that if at first you don't succeed, try it again. And so that's what Saul does. And he, in this case, he starts to use his younger daughter, Michal. And we see here that the hope is that Michal would be a snare to David. And this could mean a couple of things. We see that word snare used previous to this in the Old Testament almost always to refer to the snare that other gods would have to the Israelites. So it's possible that Michal was not a true believer, but was maybe worshiping something else. And so it could be that Saul's hope was that, hey, if I give my pagan daughter, maybe she'll entice him and the Lord will leave him. That could be what's going on. I don't know. I think it's more likely that he's just referencing the fact that if David goes and does this thing that I'm asking, if he goes and kills 100 Philistines and cuts off their foreskins, that is actually going to be seen by the Philistines as a detestable act. It's really going to be seen, in a sense, as a desecration of their bodies. And so that would have made David a marked man by the Philistines. There would have been a contract out for his head, likely. But in this case, this time, David goes ahead and accepts the proposal, and he agreed to the terms, and he actually doubled the price that was demanded from 100 to 200 foreskins, and he provides that all by the established date. And so Saul gave Michal to David, and they were married. That brings us to the last here, which I've entitled an epilogue. Really, this is a summary or a conclusion of the chapter, and I've called this a settled enemy. That begins in verse 28. And by the way, Saul has tried by this point killing David himself, removing him from his presence, trying to entice him into marrying a daughter with a promotion, making David a marked man with the Philistines, and possibly hoping that his daughter would lead David astray to follow other gods. Unfortunately for Saul, nothing worked. So we read here in verse 28, it says, when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. So the conclusion here tells us a couple of things. And that's that Saul, at this point, became David's continual enemy. And then secondly, that David continued to prosper due to God's presence with him. Now, there are a couple of lessons here, and I'm just going to show them on the screen, and then we're going to move on. But the first one I'll just mention very briefly, but that we as believers need to be like Jonathan, legitimately thankful for the gifts that God places in other believers, even when those gifts outshine our own. That's an important thing. And then I'll just mention it briefly. We're really going to see this throughout the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, but the significant lesson that begins to develop here, that even though God had selected David as his chosen instrument to bring about his will in Israel, that there's going to be about 15 years in which David is going to get run through the ringer running from Saul before this promise from God is ultimately fulfilled.